Welcome to the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, hosted by the Child Welfare Division of the South Carolina Department of Social Services. This is an intentional space for us to talk together, discover together, and grow together. If you have a passion for serving children and strengthening families, then you have come to the right place.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast. I'm your host, Emily Madier, Deputy State Director of Child Welfare Services, and we are so happy that you're joining us today for our fourth episode. This space is one that we've created to chat about practice updates and changes that we want to see in child welfare in South Carolina. We talk about practice shifts and culture changes that we're seeing or that we want to see, and how we can shape our system to do better for children and families. Today, we get to talk about a topic that impacts every child and youth in foster care, as well as their case managers, their supervisors, and their leadership. And that topic is placement. Placement can be a complex and sometimes difficult to understand process and system. It's also a part of our service array for children and families, so it aligns with our focus areas in child welfare for 2023, which are assessments, teaming, and service array. Today, I'm really excited that we get to have a conversation with two of the best experts about placement in our state, Don Barton, who's our Director of Permanency Management, and Jocelyn Gibson, who is our Placement Services Director. Let's talk a little bit about Don. So Don's our SCDSS Child Welfare Director of Permanency Management. And Don completed her Bachelor's of Social Work at Columbia College. She's been working in child welfare with SCDSS for 25 years, and she served as a CPS investigator and supervisor, an adoption specialist and supervisor, and regional adoption administrator, and was also a regional director. Don's proudest accomplishments are being a wife, mother, and growing and leading in the field of child welfare. And Jocelyn Gibson graduated from Clemson College, and she developed her passion for child welfare work early in life. She's been employed with SCDSS for 16 years in a variety of roles, and she started her current role as the agency's first placement services director in September of 2022. Welcome, Jocelyn and Don.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we usually like to ask a question to just get us started and help our listeners learn a little bit more about you beyond just your typical bio. So the question I want to ask each of you is, what got you into the work of child welfare and what makes you stay? Don, want to start with you?
Sure. So for as long as I can remember, I've adored children and loved everything about family. But what really led me to be an advocate for children and families was my mom. So I watched her work relentlessly to advocate for her patients and their families. She was the hospital's patients' rights advocate. Watching her passion and commitment serving and advocating for some of South Carolina's most vulnerable citizens helped guide my path to become a social worker. This is year 25 for me, and what has kept me in the work all these years is pretty simple. I want to keep learning and doing all I can to contribute to our system's transformation that supports all children and youth growing and thriving in a family.
I love that. What a beautiful vision and mission that you have to just continue to grow and learn. That's so beautiful. And I love the connection with your mom too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Jocelyn, what about you?
Well, interestingly, mine also relates to one of my parents. I guess you could say DSS work is in my blood. My mother was a career child welfare employee within Department of Social Services. So being able to observe sort of in a general manner throughout my childhood, some of the challenges and successes, the things that she really enjoyed about the agency, I was able to get an understanding and deep respect for the importance of this work and really never thought about going into anything else. What I love about DSS that really keeps me going is I love being part of a bigger team working together. I love that as a team and as an employee in this agency, being able to impact positive changes. It's exciting to see where we're going right now as an agency also.
That's awesome. I love that you two have the connection that your mom is what inspired or who inspired you both to get into this work, which I think is so interesting too, because child welfare is hard work, right? And it definitely has an impact on your family. So the fact that you guys saw that and you were still inspired to get involved in this work is really cool. So let's get into start talking about placement. So our three focus areas for 2023 in child welfare are assessment, teaming, and service array. And so far, we've had the opportunity to talk about assessment and teaming. And this episode, we're going to focus on one element of our service array for children and youth in foster care, which is placements. So tell me how placements are considered a service for children and youth in foster care.
Youth in foster care need stability in their living situations to be able to gain access to their services, such as school, therapy, medical visitation with their families, and foster homes and group care placements are key in ensuring that they have this stable access to their services. So to me, that sort of lends itself to seeing placements right there in the service array for children.
Yeah, I agree, Jocelyn. And I also think that, you know, each child and youth needs that enter foster care are so incredibly unique. And so from my lens, placement services is one of the most critical service needs upon foster care entry. Traditionally, you know, out-of-home placements for children have been driven by what's available rather than by what the child actually needs. And so front-end supports and services are really, really necessary to support placement stability and permanency.
That's so good. So I think that this is really a new way of thinking about placement for our system, right? So it's not just about placement as where the child sleeps. It's about placement as a service to help meet the child's needs.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
So we recently launched the new placement services division. So tell me a little bit about what went into the decision behind a placement services division, what we think will be achieved, and what we're seeing so far.
Sure. So when we started mobilizing the placement units in each region several years ago, I don't think we understood the magnitude and the complexities of really what a placement service was. And I don't even think we thought of it in those terms. We just saw it as a bed that children and youth need to sleep in when they have to enter foster care. And so the original structure, of course, had placement services folded into the licensing structure. And I think we quickly realized that it was far greater than we imagined. And so at that point, about a year and a half ago, we started visioning out what a standalone placement services division would look like and what resources would be necessary for it to bring it to life and be successful. And so we believe that by having a dedicated placement services division, this would allow our teams to identify and wrap the necessary supports and services for the child and the placement provider to be successful.
Yeah, that's so good.
Yeah, I agree, Dawn, and really looking forward to the component that was built into the placement services division of dedicated placement specialists within each unit to even assist on the very front end when a youth moves into a placement in foster care to help on the front end with some locating of services to increase the chances of that being successful.
That's good. So you guys are really embodying this idea of placement as a service and not just the placement itself, but what else can we wrap around the placement that would help the youth be successful?
Yes, yes. But I think what we have seen just over the last several years by doing placement work has, because it was a new concept, frankly, you know, the 3 or 4 years ago, placements were, we still had intensive foster care and clinical services, and they were doing the therapeutic placements. And then you had your county teams who were responsible for locating placement. And then we evolved, of course, into these regional placement teams. And now this standalone placement services division structure. And I think what we have seen over that time and realized is that our placement stability is, well, it's not great today. Mm-hmm. And what we hope we'll be able to achieve is more stability, longer stability for children and youth in their placements by being able to put those front-end services in place sooner. I think we made referrals in the past. It's not that we didn't identify supports and services prior to today, but I think there was a delay in those referrals being made on the front end. And so what you saw was disruptions happening fairly quickly to the point where before we could even get those wraps and supports in place to help the placement provider and the child be stable.
Yeah, that's great, Dawn. So it's really you're lending this intentionality and almost even this layer of expertise onto the system. So you have people who their sole job is to help coordinate placements, to help know what services are available to stabilize placements and get the connection to those services to help just wrap that holistic process together.
Yes. And I think to Jocelyn's point, the dedicated placement services coordinators that will be new to each of the regions, those folks will become experts of the services within their entire region.
Yeah.
So when we identify a need, that person is going to be able to quickly know where to find that service within that region.
Yeah, that's great. So talk to me a little bit about when a youth comes into foster care. How do we determine what level of placement might be most appropriate for that child or youth?
Well, we always want to, from the very beginning of a foster care entry, and of course, prior to a foster care entry, assessing for kinship is always going to be priority. If we're unable to place with kinship, and even if we do, we need to do a review of the child or youth's mental health history to assess if they have a history of mental health conditions. Are they experiencing behavioral needs, medical needs, any other special needs? A great way to gain that information is through the CFTM process, the child and family team meeting, where we can work with their family of origin to see what services they may have been involved in or needing so that we can begin our plans for what type of placement in foster care they would then require.
That's great. So tell me a little bit about what different levels of placement we do have in South Carolina.
So we have a variety, obviously kinship placements, which are preferable and priority. And then you have what I refer to as non-kin family foster home settings. Mm-hmm. And you have different levels on the therapeutic foster care side. So you have level one, level two, level three. You have medically fragile. You have a variety of actual levels within that therapeutic foster care array, depending on the needs of the child.
Yeah.
You also have group care, which also have a variety of levels depending on the needs of the child. So you have group care one, which is not considered a therapeutic provider. You've got group care two and group care three. Group care three being at this point your highest group care level. So those are for your children and youth who require more supervision, have treatment needs that go into those type placements. Then you also have your PRTFs, which are psychiatric residential treatment facilities. Those placements we DSS cannot place directly in. That requires a psychiatrist, a medical doctor, mm-hmm. to sign a certificate of need. The child has to have a diagnostic assessment, and our select health partners, which is the MCO for our children in foster care, are the entity responsible for searching for those psychiatric residential treatment facilities for those type placements. And then eventually, we hope to have in the near future, QRTPs, qualified mm-hmm. residential treatment programs, which do not require a doctor's admission into one of those programs, but will be a tier above a group care three.
Got it. Okay. So if I'm a case manager, because that's a lot of different levels of placement to try and keep in mind. So if I'm a case manager, I don't necessarily have to remember all of those different levels, right?
No.
So the process to determine what an appropriate placement would be is influenced by our CANs, right? So our child adolescent needs and strengths assessment. And then using the results of the CANs, like Jocelyn talked about, we go into the child family team meeting, and all of those experts together help make the decision about what the appropriate level of placement is for the child. And then the placement services division comes along and helps identify that specific resource and connect that.
Yes,
is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
So once we've determined what the appropriate placement level is for a child or youth, what do next steps look like for the placement services division team to help identify a placement?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's when the casework team for the youth would want to make sure that the placement services division had a universal application that accurately reflected the level of care that the youth had been recommended for. Also, the diagnostic assessment, if there's been one, and the CANs sent to the placement services team would be extremely beneficial when that placement search is in process. And from there, the placement services team is going to work with our array of providers to attempt to locate and match the very most appropriate placement for that youth.
Okay, great. So the level of care, I just want to hone in on one thing. So the level of care would be that TFC 1, 2, 3 or regular foster care or group care that we talked about just a minute ago.
Right. Yes.
Okay. And so how do our placement services division team connect with providers? Like, how do you determine which provider might be most appropriate or where a family might be located?
Well, we keep at real-time updated information about the availability of providers in this state. As a new provider might begin to engage with DSS for services, we're adding them into our list of resources. We reach out via emails, phone calls to providers. We lately have even started doing some pre-placement PCFTMs with providers if they're a match for the youth to see if that's something we would want to proceed with.
That's great. So are we always able to identify the best placement for a child right when a child comes into care?
Unfortunately not. I wish I could say that we had a placement for every single child or youth that could meet their needs immediately, but that is definitely not our reality. So when that happens, when we've exhausted that placement search that we feel like would best meet that child or youth's needs at the time, oftentimes we find ourselves having to do what we refer to as emergency placements. Okay. And so these are not intended to be long-term placement solutions for children and youth. They're oftentimes our children who have exceptional needs. They have therapeutic level needs, oftentimes end up in our emergency short-term placements. We depend heavily on our regular DSS licensed foster parents, really shoulder the majority of the emergency placements for us. And so we're so, so grateful for them. But traditionally, you know, youth in emergency placements, they do have exceptional needs. And the regional teams, you know, continue to search for long-term placements. So even when they're in these short-term emergency placement, the search does not stop. Right. It continues over and over again. We have gotten real creative how we approach providers, as opposed to just sending out email and a universal application out to a child placing agency or a group home. We've gotten creative and started doing little pre-recorded videos of our children and youth, really trying to shine their strengths. And we've been pretty successful with that. It really brings them to life off of a piece of paper. Mm. Also, we have set up virtual interviews where they're, you know, we set them up at our offices or wherever they are. And we've done FaceTime, we've done Teams, Zoom, whatever, you know, it takes. And that has also yielded some positive outcomes for our children and youth, too.
Wow. I love that so much. I love the creative ideas, because when I think about a universal application, a UA, right? Like, it's so hard to describe a whole person and personality on a piece of paper. Yeah. I can't imagine what somebody would write about me if they were trying to describe me on a piece of paper like our UA. So I love, especially for our teens who are complex, like fully formed individuals, that we're doing these creative things that help their personality shine a little bit better and connect with our providers too.
Yeah, we started doing the, so even the live, I really love the live interviews, and we can do those, or the virtual interviews. Yeah. We've had a lot of good feedback from providers that say, I would have probably never considered this child or youth for our MILU or program had I not met that child virtually and been able to actually engage and have a conversation with them. So it's been successful, I think.
I love that. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk some more about kinship care. So you brought up kinship care as one of our types of placements that we have. So tell me what kinship care is for someone who may not know what that term even means.
So kinship care in South Carolina has evolved over the last several years. It's always existed, although we didn't practice necessarily in that way as a state. We've always had the ability to place children with kin. We expanded our definition last year, actually, formally in our state law. And so kinship is defined as those related by birth, marriage, or adoption. But we decided to expand our definition to include fictive kin, which are folks who, I mean, it could be your neighbor, it could be your godparent, it could be somebody who has an emotional connection and bond to you that's not necessarily related to you by blood, marriage, or adoption. So kinship really does play a significant role in particular, well, in probably in every kid's life, right? Yeah. Like, so we all have grandparents and aunts and uncles and yeah. nieces and nephews and all of those folks that we love in our families. And so when children and youth can't be with their families because of safety reasons and they have to enter foster care, the best place for them is with somebody that they know and they're already connected to. It reduces their trauma. It is proven. I mean, all the research in the world shows that their permanency outcomes are better. There's just so many benefits to kinship care.
Yeah, I love that, Dawn. You did such a beautiful job of describing what kinship care looks like. And it reminds me of this thread that keeps coming up in each of the episodes of podcasts that we do, even though we're talking about different topics. But it's this idea that it takes a village, right? And yeah. every individual, like I can look back in my history, you all talked a little bit about your connections early on in the episode, but every one of us has had a village that's wrapped around us that has helped us become the people that we are. And kinship seems to be just like an embodiment of that.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
So when would we typically be assessing for kin when we're talking about kin as a placement option?
The answer to that is always. We are never going to stop assessing for kin. We shouldn't. When we're assessing for kin, we really need to assess from every perspective of that, revisiting resources that may have been looked at in the past and weren't successful or weren't able yeah. to assist. If a kinship person is not able to be a placement resource, what can they be? Can they be a visiting resource? Can they be a support system for the youth? And we have seen a lot of creativity in that that has benefited our youth.
That's great. So I love the idea of going back and reassessing, right? That this is a continuous process. We never stop. But even if we've explored somebody in the past, the situation may have changed 3 years down the road or even months down the road. So that's awesome. How about you go about determining who a kin might be, right? Like what conversations or what questions should you be asking and who that would help determine who kin or an appropriate kin placement might be?
So on the front end, you know, we're just receiving, we're just getting that EPC or removal. You really do have to engage your parents, the children's parents, asking them, you know, who's connected,
yeah.
who in the family, again, fictive kin, a neighbor, a teacher, a coach, yeah. somebody that is weaved into the lives of those children already. That has to start day one, asking those questions and identifying those connections. We obviously also have our clear searches, which are done on every single family.
And clears like background checks?
It's like background checks, but it also produces a list of potential connections.
Great.
And so you can utilize those clear searches to help you get names and then engage the family, engage the child. Also ask the youth. If the youth is old enough, they can usually tell you who are the important people in their lives.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we forget to ask the youth because we're so hyper-focused on mom and dad or, you know, other things yeah. going on in the case. So when you think about bias, you really do have to look in the mirror and think about what your beliefs are about kinship. I think we oftentimes, particularly folks who have probably been in this work a really long time, like myself, the way we view kin may need to be checked. And the way you view kin may impact your aggressiveness to actively continue to seek those kin. Sometimes I've heard things like, well, why would we place with grandma? She raised mom and now look what mom's done. Or I don't think grandma can protect because she's too close to her daughter. Well, all of those things may not necessarily be true. That's why we assess kin's protective capacity. Obviously, with kinship care, it is unique. We're asking kin to step up very rapidly. Unlike non-kin foster placements, kinship folks don't have the time to sit and think about whether they ever wanted to do this before. Foster people who want to be foster parents to non-kin, they usually have taken some time as a family to talk about, I really feel called to help in this way. But if I'm a grandparent or an aunt or an uncle, I'm not necessarily prepared to get that call. And I'm having to make a lot of decisions. So we do need to check our biases. It's okay for families to have relationships with the bio parents.
Absolutely.
And in fact, we hope that they do. so that they can be more successful at reunifying with their families.
Yeah, I love that, Dawn. So you both said so many good things in that little piece right there. So we should always look for kin and ask about everyone, right? Explore all the angles, ask everyone who the connections are, who the village is, who the support system is, and make sure that we're checking our bias, because the best thing for that child or youth, if they do have to be removed from family, is to be with people they know. So we don't want our own bias to get in the way of making that happen.
Yes, absolutely.
That's awesome. So if I have a kin caregiver, let's say I'm a case manager, if I have a kin caregiver that I identify could be an appropriate placement resource for my child or youth that's in foster care, what are the options or the next steps that I should go through?
A good place to start would be having a discussion with the placement resource about the option of kinship licensing versus unlicensed relative placement, the benefits of placing under a provisional license. If a family is interested in being licensed, then connecting with the regional kinship licensing team to make that referral and set up a staffing so that the kinship licensing team can go ahead and begin their assessment work towards the family having a kinship license.
Okay, great. So you mentioned provisional licensing, Jocelyn. So what does the provisional licensing process look like? If I were a case manager, who would I contact and what do kin caregivers receive?
So to make a referral for a family to begin the provisional kinship licensing process, you're going to connect with your regional kinship foster care program coordinator in each region. What you'll be sending to them is the results of your home assessment on the identified kinship resource and the background checks. The kinship licensing team in each region is happy to send you a checklist or a tip sheet on what is needed to make that referral. And after you've made the referral, there'll be a staffing set up to talk with you about all the next steps for what the family can expect.
And then once it's staffed with the regional foster family license support team for provisional licensure consideration, if the answer is yes, and we're going to issue that provisional license, then that family then will start accruing what we call a foster care board payment. And so it's the same foster care board payment that a child who was in a non-kin foster family placement gets. And then at that point, the licensing team will continue to work with the kinship family on getting to standard licensure over the next 90 days.
Okay, great. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about group care, because we talked about that in the beginning. We're talking about our different levels of care. But I would love to hear from you both about what the purpose of group care placement should be. And when a youth is in group care, how often should we be assessing whether it's still the most appropriate level of care?
Group care should ideally be for youth who have identified treatment needs. Really, we want youth to be in group care only if there's a therapeutic need for it. However, there are times that a youth is in group care because they're recommended for a foster home, whether that's therapeutic foster care or regular foster care, but a foster home is not available for them. And there should be continuous assessment for when a youth may be ready to step down from that more restrictive level of care to a foster home setting or a kinship setting. We have some things that the agency is doing, such as our quarterly congregate care staffings, placement CFTMs, clinical staffings with your well-being team. Those are all good decision-making discussion times for potential step down.
That's really helpful, Jocelyn. So there's really two potential, in our current like state, there's two potential things that could happen, if I'm hearing you right. So a youth could be in a group care setting because that is the most appropriate placement for them right now because they're receiving some level of treatment. And in those settings, we would be assessing or using our well-being teams and our staffings to determine when it's appropriate for that youth to step down. But there's also this situation where a youth could be more appropriate for a therapeutic or a regular foster care setting, but because one isn't available right now, kind of what Dawn talked about, right? Then they might go temporarily into group care. But in those settings, we should be constantly working with placement to find that appropriate placement, right?
Absolutely.
So what does the process look like if I, as a case manager, identify that it might be time for my youth to step down to a family-like placement? What should that look like?
So definitely the CFTM needs to occur. So you could call a placement CFTM. You can call a placement CFTM anytime. It doesn't necessarily have to just be if a child's on the verge of disrupting or something else. You can call a placement CFTM anytime to bring the team together and discuss stepping that child or youth down. Ideally, it would involve a placement team member and a well-being team member would be a part of that staffing. In particular, important for the well-being team to be involved in those children who are in therapeutic placements. Because as we discussed a short time ago, there are different levels within the therapeutic foster care setting, as well as in our group care setting. And so they can assess, they have the clinical expertise to be able to reassess their level of care to determine if they are ready to step down either to a lower level of care, or perhaps you might think they might need a higher level of care. Yeah. That's also a likely scenario with some of our children and youth.
Yeah, that's good. So, I mean, simply, you said a lot of great stuff, Dawn, but if I could just simplify it. So if I'm a case manager and I think that my youth may need, it may be time for them to transition to a different level of care, whether that's lower because they're doing really well and they are stabilized and we can step them down, or maybe higher if they need a higher level of treatment. All I need to do is just call that placement CFTM.
Yes.
Nice. Awesome. So let's talk about when placement is at risk of disruption. What steps can we try to take to help preserve the placement?
Well, I'm also going to go back to the placement CFTM. That's been an amazing tool we have in our toolkit now for youth placement needs. We don't want to wait until a discharge notice has been issued for a youth to move from a foster home or group home. If we're sensing, or you're sensing as a case manager, that the placement needs some additional services so that they can assist the youth, we want to go ahead and pull together that placement CFTM meeting, including well-being team. Even if the youth doesn't already have a therapeutic level of care designation, they will have a wealth of resources and suggestions. So during that, we can talk about what else could be put in there. We have a lot of resources now with our wraparound service programs, such as Thompson Family Services in the upstate, for example. We've become really creative, I feel like, in some of our things we're doing to support families and kinship families lately, such as helping them locate babysitters to use with some supports from the agency towards that. So I think really it's just bringing that team together.
So if I bring that team together, then they can help me determine what might be available and how to access it, right?
Yes.
That's awesome. So you're just using your resources around you to just help stabilize the youth. I love that idea. The teaming process really is that mechanism to help get answers and then help make those connections too.
Yes. Yes.
That's great. So what are our biggest struggles in placement right now?
I think Joss and I would probably could sing this like in unison if we had to. I think, you know, I know having the, you know, adequate placements for teens is a real pain point in the system. I think we see an awful lot of teens entering our system and just do not, frankly, have adequate placement resources for them.
Yeah.
And so that has been, and our teens are unfortunately usually the ones, you know, with exceptional needs who end up in these emergency type placements that we talked about before, that they tend to have the highest rate of emergency placements.
Mm. Jocelyn, anything else you want to add?
I agree with everything you said. I think that's what the placement services division team see every day. And of course, the county casework team see that it's their teens and older youth who are struggling due to the lack of resources.
So I know that there's a lot of work that's happening with both of your teams on trying to address some of these struggles that we see every day. So could you share a little bit with us about what's happening across the state to try and remedy these challenges and create more resources?
I would say over the last really year or more, we have been working collaboratively with our provider partners to create services, including placement resources for our teens, our SIB groups, our LGBTQ plus population, because that really is sort of our targeted approach and where we find that we have the most deficits in our placement array.
Okay.
CPAs have recently worked with an outside consultant that we brought in to to enhance their recruitment plans and participated in targeted recruitment training. That was very successful. That particular consultant continues to have ongoing contact with them for over the next several months.
And CPA is Child Placing Agency?
Child Placing Agency, okay. Yes. So those are our providers who are on contract. They have therapeutic foster homes, and they also have just regular foster homes. And that's who we send those universal applications to try to access placement resources for our children and youth. We also recently issued a contract, what we called as the Exceptional Needs Pilot, with our therapeutic foster care providers. That pilot consists of our therapeutic foster care CPAs that signed on, that felt like they could do what we were asking of them, to identify specialized foster homes to meet the needs of our youth with exceptional needs, i.e. our teen population in particular, and to wrap the youth in services for up to 90 days in hopes of stabilizing and being able to transition the youth to a long-term placement and hopefully within their own continuum was the idea. We're also collaborating with our providers on new placement contracts. So building out what we want eventually be future state will be our moderate level group care and our enhanced level group care.
Yeah, that's great. There's a lot of work going on to help build resources across the system.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Awesome.
And Jocelyn has been intimately involved in that. So Jocelyn, I don't know if you have anything else to add.
Our list was exactly the same, Dawn. I'm excited about all of that that's going on. Of course, when we have the QRTPs able to be ready to accept our youth that are higher level, it frees up space in the group care levels for youth that are in need of that level. And I'm just really proud of the relationships that the placement units are doing as well to make sure that our relationships with our providers stay strong. And of course, in addition to all the casework teams that work so well with the providers.
Yeah, that's great, Jocelyn. I think that's such an important thing to highlight too is in our work, in the work of social service and social work, relationships are so integral. And so taking the time to build those relationships with our provider partners who are part of this system, right? We can't do it without them, who are part of the system to help us make sure that we have appropriate placement for you. That's awesome. So everything that you all are working to create is all geared at this goal of making sure first that you have the best appropriate placement right when they come into foster care, but also working on eliminating those barriers of emergency placements like you talked about for our teens.
Yes.
What are you really proud of in terms of progress that's been made and how we as an agency are performing when it comes to placement of our children and youth in foster care?
Well, again, I'm going to mention the PCFTMs, which you can tell I am quite a fan of that process and so glad that we have it. When that first rolled out, the requirement of holding one every time that there was going to be a placement change, I'll admit, even I myself, I thought, I just don't see how that's going to be doable. And now we're to the point that that is our standard practice. I have been involved and am involved still in many of those. I've seen some really wonderful outcomes from them. We've stabilized placements that were at risk of disruption. We've facilitated placements of youth into placements that had a little bit of hesitancy, but we were able to put some things on the front end to set the placement up for success. When we haven't been able to preserve the placement, we've been able to work out longer notices to prepare for their next placement, always gaining valuable information towards their next placement from that process. And of course, there's been times that we loop back to kin that we may have explored before and determined as a team that, you know, we want to try this again. So I think everything about that process that has been a big time investment for everybody involved, but it has really proven to be such an amazing benefit towards placement for our youth.
Yeah, I love that, Jocelyn. You've definitely talked a lot about teaming, which I love because it is such a great asset for our system because it brings all of the experts together, all focused on how do we provide what this youth needs to help stabilize them, help make sure that their needs are met. So I love that you keep bringing us back to that teaming process.
Yeah, and I mean, we still have... I always say this, we still have a long way to go to work on our stability challenges and having adequate placement resources for our teens and our SIP groups. But I mean, over the last year, I feel like we have made extensive progress. And just to add to what Jocelyn's already said, the universal applications have always been sort of a pain point for our provider world. We have since I've been in this role, I can't think of a time when a universal application issue has not come to the front when we're meeting with providers. And so I'm really proud of the extensive progress that has happened, the teaming that has happened with the well-being teams and our case manager staff to improve the quality of the information that we're putting on paper about our kids, really working to make those universal applications strengths-based. Sure, do our kids have lots going on? Absolutely, some of them more than others. Mm-hmm. But really trying to paint and highlight their strengths as opposed to picking out all of the things that are not going well with that child or youth has been really, really important. I think also just the creativity and how we present our kids. So again, lifting them off of that piece of paper, because it is a piece of paper and it's hard to bring to life somebody on a page. And so I love the videos and the virtual interviews. It's been great. And we have created a true teaming approach around placement. Mm-hmm. You know, like the daily regional calls that happen. I mean, that's been incredible. And it's not just that. It doesn't end at that. There's a lot of cross-regional teaming that has been created over the last year that I think we would be in a way worse place a year later had we not developed some of those teaming approaches to our practice. And so I'm really proud of everybody. It was, I think you've heard me say this, Emily, but it was painfully beautiful. Mm. You know, almost a year ago, we sort of started this massive teaming undertaking. And I think it was a little bit of a shock to the system because we were all operating in silos when it came to placement and things that impacted placement, very much impacted placement. So now you have all hands on deck and it's kind of like whatever it takes, you know? So I love it.
Yeah, I love it too. So I'll just piggyback on yours, Dawn. I think one of the things I'm most proud of, because I think there's been such immense progress in this area over the last year, but one of the things I'm most proud of is the work that's being done around placement of youth over the last year, right? With the regional staffings and with everybody coordinating together, I think is really the best example in our entire system of breaking down silos and everybody taking joint ownership for the outcomes for our children, youth, and families. And so I'm just really proud of the collaboration at every level of the system and cross systems. And I think it's just been something really beautiful to watch, even if it did start painfully.
Yeah, amen.
So let's talk a little bit about our practice model and how practice model integrates with placement. So how does GPS, maybe specifically our guiding principles and core practice standards, how do they come into play throughout our placement process?
And looking over the guiding principles again, I really could not find anywhere where they were not woven through every single aspect of the process. In particular, you know, the family-centered, where we're doing the PCFTMs, we're doing the teaming, trauma-informed, you know, we're working hard on our CANs and our universal applications as to how we present our youth. Again, with the individualized and strength-based, a lot of work has gone into the universal applications and making sure that we're focusing on a youth's strengths. And of course, culturally responsive is something that just as a whole agency, we're working really hard on.
I agree, Jocelyn. I feel like it is like literally the fabric of the work.
Yeah.
Like !! And I've just been so, I honestly have just been so honored to witness. And I keep going back to this last year, but I really think we have just like turned the Titanic around in the bathtub, so to speak. I've been really honored to witness that our teams really shift their placement practice and live out what our practice model really bleeds, if you will. And it's, I mean, even down to the way that we refer to our children, the way that we talk about them, even when they've been through some incredibly horrible things and their very short lives here on earth. But really, again, that trauma-informed, taken into consideration what trauma they've experienced and the behaviors that are happening, the things that, we're seeing evolve out of this youth is a direct reflection of the trauma that they have experienced in their lives. And I've really just been in awe of our staff. It's been an adaptive challenge is what I really say. And but they have adapted their, I don't even know. I don't have a lot of words to describe it because it's really just been pretty spectacular.
Yeah, I agree. I think one of the really cool things that's come out of the twice daily staffings too has been the opportunity to model, right? So I've seen both of you model how to be trauma informed about our youth, right? How to talk about them and advocate for them in a trauma informed way. Not just referring to the challenges that might be on the paper or on the UA, but recognizing everything that they've been through. And so I'm really proud to see both of you model that. And I think that that modeling has spread really wide in our, I mean, all the way down to our county staff, right? Being able to change the way and really recognize the challenges that our youth have experienced and how that might lead to some of the challenges that they're experiencing today.
Yes. Mm.
So, I mean, I love that you both said that GPS is embedded in every area of placement, right? Because that's how it should be throughout all of our work, right? It should be in every level. So that's really cool. So we have talked about a lot of information today. If staff wanted to learn more about the placement process or they have questions, who should they reach out to?
I feel really like you could reach out to anyone on any of the placement services teams. Our team love their jobs and are happy to share information, but specifically, each region has a placement supervisor, a placement program coordinator. They're a wealth of information. They're happy to provide training for any of your teams in the counties. We and they are all here to provide education, clarification, problem solving, love suggestions on anything that you would like to see. Use your placement units as a resource. They are there to help.
That's awesome. And so I always like to ask this question because I feel like it kind of brings us back to the center. But I'd love to hear from each of you. If you had to give one sentence about what you would want staff to know about placement, what would that be?
So if I had to do one sentence, which for Dawn Barton, most would say is absolutely impossible. But I'm going to do it, y'all. I'm going to do it. Children, I would say that children and youth thrive best in families. And families that are supporting our youth, whether kin or non-kin, need our support to make the first placement the only placement. So again, children and youth thrive best in families. Mm-hmm. And families that are supporting our youth, whether kin or non-kin, need our support to make the first placement the only placement.
I love that. That's beautiful. Jocelyn?
Dawn and I realized that we interpreted the question a little bit differently. Dawn answered it about placement as a concept, and I answered it as to what would I want staff to know about the placement services division.
Nice.
So I would like DSS staff to know that the placement services division is here to support our foster care youth, but also to support you. Your work is so important, and your days are long and difficult. We in the placement services team want to support you in any possible way we can. And it's an internal value and mission of the placement services team that we're always going to operate with a tone of mutual understanding and respect with each other, with the county staff, with our providers. So back to, we're here to support you and the youth.
I love that. I mean, both of those just tie together so beautifully. I'm glad you guys interpreted it differently
because
I
think
it's perfect. It's perfect. Well, thank you both so much for your time and for your expertise today. It's been so helpful to learn more about the placement process, how an appropriate level of placement is determined, and how the placement process aligns with our guiding principles and standards practice model. And also what we're trying to do to improve quality placements across the state, recognizing that we have struggles, we have barriers, but that we're actively working to build a better system to address those barriers. And thank you all to all of our listeners for joining us for another episode of the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast. If you liked what you heard, please like, follow, and subscribe. And until next time, I'm your host, Emily Medeer. And remember, you are valued, you are important, and you are making a difference.
Thank you for joining us for the Driving Sustainable Success in Child Welfare podcast, hosted by the South Carolina Department of Social Services. If you liked what you heard, please follow and subscribe to the show. And until next time, remember, policies, mandates, and regulations will come and go. But successful, sustainable change is the result of thoughtful and passionate people collectively striving daily to improve the experiences and outcomes for all.